You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 345, Ezekiel and John 15, The Vine and the Branches. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
I can't complain.
Can't complain. You always ask me how I'm doing, so I decided to throw that back at you.
Nah, I can't complain.
What's new in Abilene?
Not much. Nothing, Mike. Nothing.
Hey, it's cool here. Now, it's not. I'm actually kind of missing. See, fall's my favorite time of year, and I've actually wondered what's it going to be like, essentially not having seasons. But it feels like fall weather, even though it doesn't look like it. So it's not so bad. I'm getting over it.
Yeah, those winds coming off the ocean can get pretty chilly.
Hey, it on.
My favorite weather is when you can wear a long sleeve shirt and shorts. That's my absolute favorite. About 55 degrees, 60. Whew. Perfect.
Yeah. We had a couple of days like that here, no humidity. So it's awesome.
Making me jealous now.
Yeah. It's not raining. Yeah. It's not raining all the time, like in the Northwest. So this is about perfect, but there's no like change in the colors, I like that too, but. Palm trees are palm trees, whatever. I guess I can live with that.
Yeah, I think our cruise should have been coming up here this weekend or the next weekend. So teardrop, because it would have been fun to see the fall in the New England area, because I haven't made it up there too many times, but especially that time of the year is special. So
sad. My brother has actually done that. In New England for the fall, and he says it's just spectacular, but I'll just have to imagine. I'll go look at pictures or something.
Yeah. Well, maybe next year, Mike. Maybe next year we can make it happen. Maybe COVID will cooperate. And here in a few weeks after the election, maybe it'll magically disappear. I don't know. Hopefully.
Yep.
Fingers crossed. It'll
magically go away. Oh, boy.
Well, Mike, I want to remind everybody real quick to go vote. Don't forget, the next book study is coming up. So go to nakedbiblepodcast.com, put your vote in. Let us know between Jude, Jonah, or, believe it or not, Revelation, Mike.
The Old Testament and Revelation. And you must go to the website to vote. You can't like do a mail-in ballot.
So
you got to go to the website.
That's right. Absolutely. I'm interested to see where we land with that, Mike. Keeping an
eye
on it.
It's no contact voting for the topic.
No protesting, no nothing. It's final. Whatever the result is what the result is. Mike.
Yeah.
We're still connecting dots. What dot are we connecting this week?
Well, we are going to, as the title suggests, take a look at Ezekiel and John 15. So we're back to Ezekiel. We weren't gone for long. And I will say this is probably our last visit for a while. We will see Ezekiel again, of course, especially if, the Revelation topic wins. But we're back in Ezekiel. And we're once again, I'm going to springboard off the source that we utilized in two prior episodes on the use of Ezekiel in the Gospel of John. So here we are again, like I said. And that is Gary T. Manning's book, Echoes of a Prophet, The Use of Ezekiel in the Gospel of John and in Literature of the Second Temple Period. And as I mentioned before, I'll mention it again, do not go out to Amazon and look for this book because it's $230. Don't be foolish. Don't spend $230 on a book. If you like this stuff, I'm just pulling out a few extracts of the book. The book's a lot wider than what we've been using it for. Go up to Logos, logos.com, and get the book for $28 in digital form. That's a whole lot smarter. And if you don't like reading books on a screen, which I don't, print it. Just print it out. Do not spend $230 on a book. Anyway, we're going to start with John 15 and, again, utilizing Manning as a springboard, as we noted before. But I think probably the easiest, most logical way to jump into the subject here is to read John 15. I know this is a familiar passage, but it may not be so familiar that you're just going to have all the elements in your head automatically. So I'm going to read John 15, 1 through 17, and we will get started. So again, reading from the ESV, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away like a branch and withers, and the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. By this, my Father is glorified that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give it to you. These things I command you so that you will love one another. So that is the vine and the branches. You know, people have called it a parable or an allegory. Again, it's pretty familiar to a lot of listeners, a lot of Christians. But less familiar is the reality that what Jesus is talking about here is drawn again, from the Old Testament. Okay, so we need to know what that context is so that we don't overinterpret or badly interpret, okay, what he's saying here. I mean, this is building on something. Okay, there are points of reference here that we need to know about. And I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration to say that I'm willing to bet that if you've heard a sermon on this passage, you would be the exceedingly rare individual if anyone has ever taken you back to the Old Testament for it. Usually this is just a springboard to sermonic ideas about discipleship and so on and so forth. And it's not that those ideas don't have merit or deserve attention. It's just that there's just some things going on here that would help in understanding and not overinterpreting or misinterpreting what's going on. Now, you know, scholars are well aware of the relationship of John 15 to the Old Testament. There's actually several Old Testament candidates for the source of Jesus' parable. We'll just call it a parable about the vine and the branches. The three candidates, if you get into the literature, are Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, Jeremiah 2, 21 through 22, and Ezekiel 15, 1 through 8, along with Ezekiel 17, 1 through 10. So pick a prophet, Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel. I'm going to go through each one and sort of, you know, explain why it's a candidate. We are, as you could guess already, we're going to land on Ezekiel, and we'll get into the reasons as to why it's a pretty high degree of certainty that this is what's going on in John 15, the connection back to these Ezekiel passages. But let's just start with Isaiah 5. In Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, I'm just going to read that in the ESV, and then we want to make a few comments about vocabulary from the Septuagint that connects to John in some ways. Okay, it's not, the relationship's not very tight, as we're going to see, but there are points of connection. So Isaiah 5, this is the vineyard of the Lord destroyed. So this is where typically, if anybody kind of ever thinks about the Old Testament relationship to John 15, this is sort of the default place where people end up going. And I'm going to read the first seven verses. Isaiah 5 says, "Let me sing for my beloved, my love song concerning his vineyard. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it. And he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? And now I tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry." So this is, you know, God, you know, referring to his vineyard, you know, his beloved, which turns out to be Israel, and the planting metaphor is there, of course, in relationship to a vineyard. It doesn't yield what it's supposed to yield, and then this is God's response, you know, to what's going on. If you look at Isaiah 5 in the Septuagint, there are a few words, like two, that actually have resonance with John 15. So there's really not a whole lot of connection, even though in the service it might sound like it is. But for instance, in Isaiah 5:2, we have, you know, the reference to the vine. Okay, the Greek is ampelos. We have a reference to pruning, which is the verb kaphire, in John. Anyway, that's the tense form. So those are the two terms. One's a noun, one's a verb that show up and that link, you know, or at least are present between Isaiah 5 in the Septuagint and John 15. So it's not a whole lot, actually. I mean, again, this passage is commonly thought to be what's behind John 15. But, you know, again, Manning takes us through the details. If you had his book, you would, you know, you read how, you know, he discusses this. And he says the verbal parallels between Isaiah 5, 1 through 7 and John 15, 1 through 10 are not very impressive since they consist only of synonyms. I mean, you basically have synonym overlap, vine and pruning. You know, you might have like one or two instances where you have actually a shared term, but most of the similarity is not explicit. And so, you know, when you're looking for, to answer the question, hey, what is the writer of John? What's John doing here? You know, if he's using the Septuagint to draw his reader's attention to a particular passage, he's probably going to borrow more vocabulary from a particular passage that will telegraph, this is where I'm looking and this is where I want you to look. He wouldn't just sort of use synonyms, synonymous language. And again, we have very little explicit connectivity here. So Manning brings that to our attention. He says, nevertheless, you know, hey, you know, sure, there are thematic parallels here. So he writes the passage, you know, Isaiah 5 resonates in a number of ways with Jesus' parable of the vine. God is the gardener, although he's not given the title. In Isaiah 5, the emphasis is placed on God's care for the vineyard and the vine. He builds a fence, a tower, and a wine vat. Then plants and tends the vine. He waits for grapes, but the vine produces only, you know, thorns or these wild grapes. As in John 15, the lack of fruit results in judgment. In both John 15 and Isaiah 5, pruning is only for the fruitful vines. God's protection and nurture are only directed towards those who bear fruit. So he says, you know, there's conceptual thematic parallels here, but again, we're expecting John, if he's looking at Isaiah, chapter 5, if he's actually looking at that passage as he's thinking about Jesus' teaching here, or if Jesus himself, again, in real time, is thinking of this passage from Isaiah in the Septuagint, you would expect the connections to be either more numerous and, I would say, also more direct. But they're not. And so for that reason, scholars, a number of them move on to another possibility, and that is Jeremiah. So Jeremiah 2, 21 and 22. It's only two verses, so let's just go there and read that. Jeremiah 2, 21 reads as follows, ESV. "Yet I planted you a choice vine, holy of pure seed. How then have you turned degenerate and become a wild vine? Though you wash yourself with lye and use much soap, the stain of your guilt is still before me, declares the Lord." You know, if we go back up, you know, and get the context again, this is Jeremiah. So this is going to be, you know, directed toward Jerusalem or Judah. I mean, the northern kingdom is already gone by Jeremiah's time. So it has sort of the same flavoring here that as far as what it's aimed at. The point of the connection is the first line of John 15, where he says, "I am the true vine." In Greek, it's he ampelos, he alethenos. "And my Father is the gardener." Again, he prunes every branch that bears fruit. And that's karpon pheron in Greek. Well, if you go to Jeremiah 2:21, we read, "I planted you a fruit-bearing vine." It's going to sound, you know, familiar with the Greek because, again, it is familiar. It's pretty direct. Ampelon karpophoron. Okay, so we've got some direct, you know, words drawn from Jeremiah 2 in the Septuagint in John 15. "So I planted you a fruit-bearing vine, entirely true, pasan alethanane." So we've got connections with ampelos, with alethanos, alethanane. We've got karpon pheron in John 15. We've got karpophoron in a participle form in Jeremiah 2:21. I think that's a participle. I'm reading it in English letters here, so I'm not quite sure of the form. But anyway, the point is the shared vocabulary here. So we get a little bit more explicit. And Manning comments, he says, "The first two words constitute a strong parallel since they occur in the same phrase separated by two other adjectives in Jeremiah 2:21. The parallel extends to more than just the parallel words, however. In John, God is specifically called the gardener." It's a different term here. It's georgos. In Jeremiah 2:21, God clearly functions as the gardener without the title. God plants the vine, and part of the point of the oracle, Jeremiah 2:1 through Jeremiah 3, verse 4, is that Israel has rejected God despite God's care for her. The phrase karpon pheron in John 15:2 parallels karpophoron in Jeremiah 2:21, but there's a subtle modification. In Jeremiah 2:21, fruit-bearing is a metaphor for Israel's earlier faithfulness and usefulness to God, in contrast to Israel's later apostasy. In John 15, the vine is Jesus, so there's no thought of his apostasy, obviously. The metaphorical element of fruit-bearing is thus transferred from the vine to the branches. That's not, you know, you don't get that in Jeremiah 2, but you do get that in John 15, is Manning's point. There, to finish up Manning's quote, "The meaning of fruit-bearing is essentially the same as in Jeremiah, except, you know, you've got different targets. Branches that do not bear fruit are apostate and worthless. Branches that bear fruit are faithful and useful." So he goes on and talks about the themes of faithfulness and usefulness in both passages, both John 15, Jeremiah 2, and so on and so forth. I mean, so he says, you know, there's explicit vocabulary connection here. There's some thematic connection here, even though there's a bit of a modification. And he sort of winds up his discussion this way. He says, "The most important modification that John makes to the images from Isaiah and Jeremiah is to the identity of the vine, which we mentioned earlier. In both passages, the vine is Israel, while in John 15, the vine is Jesus." Then he goes off and he starts talking about certain features of the text that might explain how this modification is exegetically viable in case, again, you know, how do scholars argue that despite this modification that John and Jesus are still thinking of Jeremiah 2. So there are ways to sort of answer that question. You know, one thing being, married to another, in both passages, there's a different, point of connection for the bind language. So Manning talks a little bit about how, that could be justified exegetically, but then, he sort of winds up summarizing it this way. I mean, he's going to move on to Ezekiel, and when we get to Ezekiel, it's going to be pretty obvious that this really is the point. This is really the point of reference. But anyway, Manning says, however, the transfer of meaning in the vine metaphor was justified. John's allusions to the vine imagery in Isaiah and Jeremiah suggest that Jesus is faithful Israel. Again, so if you're gonna look at those two passages, Isaiah and Jeremiah, if that's the trajectory you're thinking or following, Jesus is the faithful Israel. Israel had been the true vine, but now is useless and faithless. Jesus remained faithful. You can see already he's saying, if you want to take this trajectory, there's a contrast between the Son of God, Jesus, and the Son of God, Israel. That's, pretty apparent. So Jesus remained faithful, back to Manning, and thus God would now prune and tend Jesus and his branches instead of Israel. That's what Manning is suggesting. This is how you're going to have to take it. For the disciples, this meant that their hope of usefulness to the farmer lay in remaining connected to the faithful vine. By implication, all other vines were false and were destined for destruction. Although the passage never states it clearly, there is a suggestion that the nation of Israel was such a false vine. Now, let me just stop there again. So Manning's, doing his best to build a trajectory for how, if you're gonna opt for Isaiah and Jeremiah, this is what you can say. Okay, if you're gonna presume these are the connection points, contrast between both vines, Jesus and Israel. And Israel is a false vine, so you need to turn from that, and you need to turn toward Jesus as your Messiah. This would be the way you would handle it. Back to Manning. To put it another way, the individual's relationship with God had always been mediated through Israel. Individual fate was tied to the collective fate of Israel. Now, Jesus calls his followers to mediate their relationship to God through himself. Their fate would no longer be dependent on Israel's faithfulness and usefulness. It would now be firmly fixed on Jesus. So that's the end of the quote. Now that's all good stuff. And Manning offers it again for those who, are either scholars who argue that these two passages are what John's thinking, or again, that's preferred, something like that in terms of interpretation. So it's all good stuff, but he is going to say, there's basically something better here, or at least in terms of the level of detail, the level of transparent connectivity invariably is going to point to Ezekiel 15 and Ezekiel 17. So I'm going to read Ezekiel 15, 1 through 8, and then I'm going to read Ezekiel 17, 1 through 10. And again, you'll get the feel of it here real quickly. So Ezekiel 15, the ESV header here, it's the whole chapter, it's only 8 verses, is Jerusalem a useless vine? So again, it's marked thematically because it's going to be pretty apparent here. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, how does the wood of the vine surpass any wood, the vine branch that is among the trees of the forest? Is wood taken from it to make anything? Do people take a peg from it to hang any vessel on? Behold, it is given to the fire for fuel. When the fire has consumed both ends of it, and the middle of it is charred, is it useful for anything? Behold, when it was whole, it was used for nothing. How much less, when the fire has consumed it, and it is charred, can it ever be used for anything? Therefore, thus says the Lord God, like the wood of the vine among the trees of the forest, which I have given to the fire for fuel, so have I given up the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And I will set my face against them. Though they escape from the fire shall yet consume them. And you will know that I am the Lord when I set my face against them. And I will make the land desolate because they have acted faithlessly, declared the Lord God. Now I want you to hold on to that thought. The wood that is thrown into the fire in Ezekiel 15 is that's its fate, because ultimately, the wood itself is useless And then when he takes that point and analogizes it to the people of Jerusalem, they get thrown into the fire because they have acted faithlessly. They don't believe. If they had believed, they would follow the Lord instead of following other gods. Again, we, how many times do we have to go over this? We went through the whole book of Ezekiel, but just recall that one point. Again, they have acted faithlessly. They do not, again, have faith in Yahweh. Now, if we go down to Ezekiel 17, here's where you get the other vine imagery that you find in Ezekiel. So I'm going to read 17, 1 through 10. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man, propound a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel. Say, thus says the Lord God, a great eagle with great wings and long pinions, rich in plumage of many colors, came to Lebanon and took the top of the cedar. He broke off the topmost of its young twigs and carried it to a land of trade and set it in a city of merchants. Then he took the seed of the land and planted it in fertile soil. He placed it beside abundant waters. He set it like a willow twig, and it sprouted and became a low-spreading vine, and its branches turned toward him, and its roots remained where it stood. So it became a vine and produced branches and put out boughs. And there was another great eagle with great wings and much plumage. And behold, this vine bent its roots toward him and shot forth its branches toward him from the bed where it was planted, that he might water it. It had been planted on good soil by abundant waters, that it might produce branches and bear fruit and become a noble vine. Of course, the point is, let me break in. The point is that the branches want a different eagle, okay? And they're reaching toward a different, you know, eagle. So verse 9, say, thus says the Lord God, will it thrive? Will he not pull up its roots and cut off its fruit so that it withers, so that all its fresh sprouting leaves wither? It will not take a strong arm or many people to pull it from its roots. Behold, it is planted. Will it thrive? Will it not utterly wither when the east wind strikes it, wither away on the bed where it sprouted? Now, again, the second one is a little more obtuse than the first one, but both of those passages have this vine and branch imagery. So what Manning does in his book is he produces a really detailed chart that I'm not going to go through here for the sake of the podcast. He produces a detailed chart of the vocabulary shared between these two Ezekiel passages, again, in the Septuagint in the Greek, and John 15. And to be honest, it's pretty impressive, and it's very telling because there's a lot. And he writes this. Here's how he essentially summarizes it. The amount of verbal parallel makes it clear that Ezekiel's vine parables are the dominant background to John's vine parable. Let me just stop there. So he's not saying that it isn't possible that, you know, Isaiah and Jeremiah play a role here. Okay, I mean, and he did his best to help, you know, if this is where you're going, this is what you can learn from it, glean from it, good. But at most, you've got two explicit, or in the case of Jeremiah, three explicit words between the two. And that's like dwarfed by the vocabulary from the Septuagint in these two Ezekiel passages that you find in John. So back to Manning, and this is his point. There's just so much of it here. Overall, Ezekiel's vine parables have eight words and two phrases explicitly in common with John 15. This is significantly more than the wording shared between John 15 and any other Old Testament passage. Even when only one of Ezekiel's vine parables is compared to John 15, let's just use one of the two passages. Even when you do that, the parallels are greater than with any other Old Testament passage. Isaiah 5, 1 through 7, for example, has only one word and two synonyms in common with John 15, whereas Ezekiel 17 has three words, one synonym, and one phrase in common with John 15. Ezekiel and John also share some rare words in common. Ezekiel 15 and John 15 are the only two passages in either Testament to use cognates of kathairo, that's a verb, to refer to pruning. Let me just repeat that. Ezekiel 15 and John 15 are the only two passages in either Testament to use cognates of kathairo to refer to pruning. In the first example with Isaiah, the verb was kathairo in John 15, and you have a reference to pruning in Isaiah 5, but it's actually, again, it's only a synonym. It's not the same word. So this is really telling, you know, that Ezekiel and John 15, the only two places you're going to find that have, again, this particular term used in the same context. Back to Manning. Manning says, Ezekiel is the only book in the Septuagint that regularly uses klema for branch. John 15 is the only passage in the New Testament to use that word at all. So, I mean, think about that. You know, the word for branch, klema. Septuagint of Ezekiel is the only place you're going to find it. And in the New Testament, the only place you're going to find it is John 15. So, you know, Manning says, basically, John's use of the word suggests his intention to recall Ezekiel's vine parables. I mean, he goes on it, but honestly, just that little bit is pretty solid evidence that John 15 links back to Ezekiel 15 and 17, and not Isaiah 5 or Jeremiah 2. Again, we're not, like, you know, Manning's not trying to cut them off totally, but he's like, if you're going to build the case, here are the data. Now, there are some observations that are in line with the closer relationship between John 15 and those two passages, and they provide some interpretive focus points for John 15. This is why we're doing the exercise. And by the way, you know, I hope, just, you know, sort of as a sidebar here, I hope you're learning some method as we do this. You know, if you're doing a book study, you're doing your own personal Bible study in a New Testament book, you do want, you know, you want to reference the Septuagint. And this is easy, again, if you have software, you're using an online tool or something like that, where you can see, you know, well, what's the lemma here in the Greek Septuagint, this passage, and does that show up in John? I mean, you can actually do this. And this is what you're looking for. You're looking for frequency of connection, and you're looking for, you know, explicit is more favorable than synonyms or thematic connection. Again, because if you're the writer of John, or again, if you're listening to Jesus and you know the Septuagint scriptures that well, I mean, maybe it's conceivable they could have, but, you know, either way, either trajectory there, if you can discern that Jesus, and of course the record of this in John 15, is repeatedly going to a particular place in the Septuagint, that's a good indicator that they want you to think about that. They want your mind to go back. Because if you do, it's going to help you parse what they're saying now. It's going to help you interpret. It's going to help you, you know, again, not overread or misread the passage. And this is why scholars do this sort of thing, and you can do it too. I mean, you don't need to go out and earn a degree to do this. You have, again, software, online tools. You know, you can do this sort of thing just to orient yourself when you start to think about this passage that you're studying. So anyway, you know, he says here in terms of his observations and implications, I'm just going to give you a few. In the first respect, it's pretty obvious that Ezekiel's vine parables, like John's, unlike any other place in the Old Testament, that they distinguish between the vine and the branches. This is another thing that may not be apparent from what I've already read from Manning, but, you know, in Jeremiah we have similar language, but the vine, you know, in one place is Israel and the other place is Jesus, and in the one place the vine is apostate, and of course Jesus is not. So even if you have the vocabulary, there's sort of there's a modification of what's going on here. That is not the case here. You know, in John 15 and Ezekiel, these two passages, these are the passages that distinguish the vine and the branches. They don't mix them up. These are the only two. So in Ezekiel 17, and if we kept reading, you'd also run into this in Ezekiel 19, which we have not, you know, shared at all. In Ezekiel 17, the branches are individuals and the vine is the royal Davidic dynasty of Israel. You know, later in Ezekiel 19, specifically the vine is Zedekiah. You know, he's the house of David, but he is going to be unfaithful. But it's still this individual Davidic guy. Okay, so you have more of a connection there. So that's one observation that Manning makes that says, okay, This is a little bit better than what we've run into before. So frequency of vocabulary, explicitness of vocabulary. And when we're talking ultimately contrasting one member of David's line versus the ultimate member of David's line. Okay, Jesus, the Messiah. Next thing he notes, I'm just going to read to you his second point. He says, one of the most important parallels between John 15 and Ezekiel is the use of katharo and its cognates, katharos, katharsis, to refer to pruning. Everywhere else in the New Testament and the Septuagint, these words are not used to pruning. They refer to purity and purification. So only in Ezekiel 15 and John 15 are they used to refer to pruning. That's their context. Ezekiel 15:4 describes the uselessness of vine wood. The Septuagint clarifies this by describing the uselessness of vine branches that have been pruned. Okay, again, it's interesting. His point here is that even though they got attention, okay, they still turn out to be useless. They've been pruned, but they still, normally you prune something that's producing fruit. You don't prune something that's not going to produce fruit. So they're again, for what it's worth, he says the Septuagint, again, describes the uselessness of the vine branches that have been pruned at some point. In John 15, 2 and 3, God prunes the fruitful branches, thus making them pure. And so there's a purification element there, but the context is still the pruning. John 15, he goes on and says, describes judgment on the vine in terms similar to all three of Ezekiel's vine metaphors. In John 15, 6, the fruitless branches wither. They are burned in the fire. And again, that vocabulary is going to be shared vocabulary with Ezekiel. In Ezekiel 15:4, the pruned branches serve only as fuel for the fire. In Ezekiel 17:9-10, the vine's shoots wither. Again, you get this withering of the branches and so on and so forth, in both passages. In Ezekiel, the three vine metaphors announce judgment against Jerusalem and its leaders. This is perhaps one reason for John's appropriation of Ezekiel's vine metaphor. So Manning says, again, his suspicion is that this is really why Jesus goes to this passage. Because in the Ezekiel passages, who's getting judged? It's Jerusalem and it's leadership, both political and religious. And again, in Jesus' day, this provides him with the perfect contrast between himself and his followers and those guys. Conflict with Jerusalem and its rulers is one of the driving themes of John, Manning writes, as was already seen in examining the shepherd discourse. I mean, we did that episode a few episodes ago where that's the big deal. You have the evil shepherds versus the good shepherd. Okay? This happens a lot in John. John contrasting Jesus and his disciples with the Pharisees, the religious leadership, the temple, Israel. I mean, he creates these contrasts a lot. So to this point, if one is reading or hearing or thinking about John 15, and one knew Ezekiel 15 and 17 really well, you would be led to think of the failure of the Davidic kings at the end of Judah's monarchy and their demise. Okay, because that's the context for Ezekiel 15 and 17. With impending doom, I mean, just looming right over the horizon, instead of repenting, instead of, confessing, yes, we deserve this, they don't do that. In fact, the whole thing with Ezekiel 17 about, the eagle and the two eagles and all this stuff is about how Israel tries to get help from a different source other than God. And God says it's going to fail. It's going to fail. I mean, instead of turning to me at the last moment, you're still turning somewhere else. You're still looking somewhere else. And so again, if you know that content really well, and you can see if you were at the event, when Jesus is saying this, or you're reading this in John in Greek, and again, the Septuagint, well enough to know where he's going with this, back to Ezekiel. That's the contrast. You are led to think of the failure of the Davidic kings at the end of Judah's monarchy and their demise. The vine of David has fallen in Ezekiel. It's toast. but one is also led to think of the branches, Israel's leaders in concert with and at service of that king. They're shown to be worthless. Again, the vine that goes wrong in Ezekiel and the worthless branches are those that associate with an apostate king, okay, with an apostate system. They do not turn, okay, to the one who planted, you know, the vineyard, okay, to Yahweh. They don't do it. They won't do it. You know, they're turning to other, you know, to Egypt or some other power, you know, help us, blah, you know, instead of doing, you know, what God wanted them to do. This is what God wants the result to be. He wants, you know, repentance and, again, at least a confession, you know, of what, you know, that we're in this situation because of our faithlessness. They don't do it. So, again, you're thinking of the vine of David failing, the leadership that is in the employ or connected with the failed Davidic king, they're worthless. It's not just the king's fault. It's the leadership, political leadership, religious leadership. They're worthless. They're useless. And Manning says, you know, consider the resulting parallels. And I'll pick two of them here. The failure of the vine, or let's just call it the fail vine. David's line to the time of Jerusalem's fall. Okay, if you think, let's think of it this way. This David's line all the way from David to the end of Jerusalem. You know, you get Solomon, and then after Solomon, the kingdom splits, and you've got a few, you know, godly kings of the south, but a lot of them are apostate. And it, in the end, David's line fails. Okay. The ruling son or the sons, the kings of God over, you know, Judah, the only one existing at the time of Ezekiel, it fails. In contrast, Jesus, the true Davidic king and the son, the true son, is the true vine. He does not fail in his allegiance to God. He accomplishes God's work. And so, therefore, again, if you're in his service, you're not going to fail either. You're not going to be worthless, let's put it that way. So the failure branches, the second parallel, again, would be in Ezekiel, those in service to the king. They were worthless shepherds. They were disloyal to God. They show themselves to be worthless wood to be burned. Can they get burned because of their faithlessness? Not because they really love Yahweh and they don't succeed enough. They are burned because they don't love Yahweh and they are worthless. They don't believe. They don't believe. They have attached their allegiance and their loyalty somewhere else. And again, that... this creates the context from which or out of which John 15 needs to be thought about. You know, what about the branches of the true vine? Okay, will they shift their allegiance? Will they become worthless? Will they forsake Yahweh? Will they forsake the true vine? Or will they remain believing? Will they remain with him? Again, John 15 does not call for the perfection of the believer. And that's usually, I shouldn't say it's usually the way it gets preached. It comes darn close. Okay, I've heard a number of passages on John 15 that leave you thinking, am I doing enough for God to still like me? If I'm doing enough, that means I'm abiding. And if I'm abiding, then God approves. And so, am I doing enough? Am I doing enough? Am I doing it? Okay, the point is, if you go back to Ezekiel, the point of reference is, they did squat. Okay, they didn't do anything. They were faithless. Their allegiance was somewhere else. And personally, I think it's really helpful, again, to think of John 15, you know, against this backdrop. You know, who are we actually talking about here? So Manning writes this, John 15 also shares broad themes with Ezekiel's vine images. Again, John's judgment on the fruitless branches has strong verbal parallels with the judgment on Jerusalem in Ezekiel 15. And the themes of the two images resonate as well. The main point of Ezekiel 15 is that the faithlessness of Jerusalem has resulted in worthlessness and therefore judgment. And the judged, in John 15, the judged branches fail to abide. In other words, they are faithless. They do not, they have no allegiance. They have no believing loyalty in Jesus. It's gone. Okay, so again, if we want to interpret John 15, we need to be carefully thinking about what the circumstances in Ezekiel 15 and Ezekiel 17 really are. Okay, the reason, again, that for the analogy, John 15 does not call for the perfection, the perfect behavior and perfect, never failing, you know, obedience of the believer. You know, the only, here's what we don't want to conclude. And again, you know, I've ever heard sermons that maybe they don't say this explicitly, but this is kind of what they make you think. Unless my life is an endless succession of spiritual victories, then I'm on the outs in light of John 15. Okay, that does not describe what's going on in Ezekiel 15 and 17. Their disobedience there wasn't a blip on the radar. They had no allegiance, period. And they're going to get cast away. They're going to get cast away. It's a colossal failure. So again, the message to us and, you know, the disciples in John 15 broadly, and we'll end with this. It's really about your allegiance to Jesus, the one who will not fail. Okay. You know, your believing loyalty needs to not fail. Otherwise, you would be faithless. You would be disloyal to the true God. You would be turning to some other. Again, John 15 needs to be defined in Old Testament terms of Israel's idolatry and its apostasy. It is about failure of believing in the true God and remaining loyalty in that belief. It's about refusing to align yourself with other gods. You know, the contrast is Israel's shepherds, the Davidic kings. You know, I mean, they showed which deity or how many deities they believed in and aligned with. You know, how many deities or some other deity they put their faith in, they threw their loyalty to. It wasn't Yahweh is the point. So don't end up like them. Don't end up like them. Worthless wood to be burned. Keep aligning your believing loyalty to the true vine. Doing so will mean you aren't worthless wood. You know, you don't have to be perfect wood to be useful wood. Okay, you will bear fruit since you are attached to the unfailing true vine. So again, we're just going to wrap up with that. I really think that this is a good case, John 15, where if we read it in concert with the Old Testament passages to which it connects, and it connects in really not only frequent ways, but very particular ways. You know, this is the only time this word occurs, Septuagint of Ezekiel, John 15. I mean, these things tell you where to go for your thinking in terms of how to parse John 15. It tells you. It's like a cheat sheet. Okay, you look for these little things, and the writer directs you, the speaker directs you as to how to parse this stuff. So in this case, I think it's really important because, again, of this, you know, I can only speak if I was a pastor. Yes, I want people to be disciples. Yes, I want them to live holy lives. But God forbid that I equate, you know, discipleship and define it in such a way where people, you know, leave my church and think that unless their life is an endless string of spiritual victories, they're going to burn. That's just wrong. It's just wrong. You know, ultimately, here we go again. It's about believing loyalty, and I think this is a good illustration of it.
All right, Mike. Yeah, I'd be interested if there's any pastors out there that actually did do a sermon on this. Send us an email.
You know,
I'd like to hear their take on it.
It's sobering. You know, it's a sobering passage, but it shouldn't be a bludgeoning, or, you know, just cast me to the wind now, you know, kind of thing. It's just, I've seen this. And so, you know, when I came across this, I thought, you know, we need to loop this passage in, you know, to this little, I don't know what you'd call it, a mini series that we're doing here, but I think this is great. a good one to include.
Yeah. And also, Mike, you know who I think agrees with us? I was looking at our rankings, and this is just for iTunes only, but we were the number one Christian podcast a few weeks ago, Mike, in Israel, and we were the number two Christian podcast in Finland. Yeah. So our Finnish friends, thank you. And our Israeli friends, thank you. Thank you all for listening. That's awesome.
Good.
So, yeah. And also,
yeah, that's good to hear. I'm glad, because I'm hoping people pick up a little bit on method for their own Bible study. And again, are prompted to think about, you know, the connectivity. I just think it's important.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I will remind people, go vote. And I'm talking about the Naked Bible Podcast vote. NakedBiblePodcast.com. Go vote for the next book study, Mike. All right.
Absolutely.
Well, with that, I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.